Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
McDonald's, a public nuisance for some workers. Pepsi drivers on strike in Indiana over health care costs. How many to be affected when pandemic assistance runs out? And today on the show, the CWA, Local 1102, and the News Guild setting an organizing record. Welcome to the Monday, August 16th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on five platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. We have actually three guests on the show today. We're doing a segment with the Communication Workers of America 1102. They're on the East Coast, New York, New Jersey area. Steve Lawton is going to start it off. He's president of that local, been president for 6 years, started as a shop steward at Verizon, where he was employed since 1993. And in his time as a union leader, he helped organize many union actions, including several strikes at Verizon, one of them an eight-week-long strike in 2016. He also was lead organizer on an organizing campaign for 300 call center workers who administer the New York Easy Pass toll system. At that point, in the second segment with the local, we're going to pick up with Hope Gilmore. Now, Hope is a union activist and chief steward at Conduit, Inc. That's the Easy Pass system. Hope is a dedicated organizer who started her work during COVID-19, during the pandemic, when she took it upon herself to join union officials in warning her coworkers not to enter the call center due to a positive test of COVID-19. Well, after the action, Hope and her coworkers successfully fought and won a work-from-home agreement from their employer. That's the union difference. That's the union difference. And since then, Hope has worked on several political action campaigns. And she's a fighter. She's a fighter. So that's our first two segments. John Schlois, president of the News Guild, will be joining us later in the show. He's been on the show a couple of times, and I'll tell you, he's got some really, really good news to report. Record organizing. They have beat all previous recent records with 1,565 workers joining their union so far this year and another 1,000 in active public campaigns. Newest members are part of a surge in organizing, not just in the United States, but also Canada. Publications as big as the LA Times, Chicago Tribune, as small as the Casper Star Tribune, in places with strong union tradition like Allentown's Morning Call, states without a big union presence like Texas, Dallas Morning News, Fort Worth Star Telegram, Virginia's Roanoke Times, Florida's Miami Herald, the Orlando Sentinel, and the Palm Beach Post. I mean, this guy's on a tear. And he's got an interesting story to share about the New York Times tech campaign. Now, the New York Times is engaged in a very contentious back and forth with several hundred of the paper's technology and product staffers, who announced a unionization drive earlier this year. Now, the writers are organized, but this is crazy. They're giving them a hard time. They've hired a union-busting law firm, but they made a big mistake. It was very embarrassing when the law firm representing the paper's management accidentally sent a private strategy memo to representatives for the new unionized staff. Yeah. Michael Lebovich, a partner with the firm Proskauer Rose, sent an email to several of his colleagues at the firm and New York Times senior VP and deputy general counsel Andrew Gutterman, who represents the paper in discussions with various staff unions. The email, titled Tech Organizing Unit's Scope Decision Options, laid out options on how the paper could respond to recent efforts by tech and product staffers to form a union. What he did not realize, he also CC'd Racial Standards, an organizer for the New York chapter of the News Guild. Oops. So John is going to talk about that and more as our second guest right here on the show. Cooks and cashiers at a McDonald's in Oakland, California, where 12 workers and 8 of their family members had previously tested positive for COVID-19, signed a settlement with McDonald's in which the restaurant agreed to various COVID-related safety measures. Following a similar settlement 2 weeks earlier in Chicago, the Oakland settlement comes after a 33-day-long strike, one of the longest in McDonald's history, as well as a lawsuit filed by workers and their family members for which a judge granted a preliminary injunction last year. The lawsuit was based on a public nuisance doctrine to safeguard the health and safety of workers. Pretty clever, right? Now, public nuisance is typically defined as when a defendant's conduct creates, quote, an unreasonable interference with a right common to the general public, and has traditionally been used to address property owners infringing on the rights of public, like a smelly cattle field lot near a very populated area. That's a good example there. That would be a public nuisance. The successful application of the doctrine to workplace safety in a pandemic follows a similar settlement with employees of a McDonald's restaurant in Chicago reached just 2 weeks earlier. In that case, a judge also granted a preliminary injunction last spring, which the settlement rendered permanent. Angie Rodriguez is one of the striking workers at McDonald's. She says, we're not going to get tired of fighting. We're going to keep on fighting. And we're going to fight with more force because we demand dignity so no other fast food worker passes through what I went through. Again, 12 workers getting sick. More than 100 drivers at a Pepsi bottling facility. This is in Munster, Alabama, responsible for delivering pop to the shelves of major grocery stores across the Midwest and represented by Teamsters Local 142. Have been on strike for nearly a month now, protesting the company's proposal to sharply raise the workers' health insurance premiums from $14 to more than $80 over the next 4 years. The workers decided to reject the disputed agreement, even though their union had endorsed it. Now, last Monday, the mayor of the neighboring city of Hammond, Indiana, Thomas McDermott Jr., who has visited the picket line, threatened a citywide boycott of Pepsi if the company failed to reach an agreement with the striking workers. I can't in good conscience continue to be a customer if they're not using union drivers, he said. If Pepsi management can't resolve their differences with the union by this Friday, August 20th, Hammond will terminate all Pepsi contracts. Mind you, last year, Pepsi had a market capitalization of more than $200 billion, reaped more than $70 billion in net revenue, and in line with EPI, that's the Economic Policy Institute findings, their CEO was compensated more than $20 million. But they can't pay their drivers or pick up their health care costs. FedEx, there's another great company. They're currently embroiled in one of the largest Fair Labor Standards Act overtime collectives in history, a suit representing 30,000 people. Well, the collective added 14 more state claims to their complaint for overtime against the company. The claims span Arkansas, Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, New Jersey, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Wisconsin. The suit's contention is that FedEx is liable as a joint employer for overtime owed to drivers who on paper work for independent contracted service providers so the company can avoid certain employment obligations. Just another example of washing their hands from workers. One more here before we break. A new report from the Century Foundation estimates that 7.5 million workers, 7.5 million in the country will lose all unemployment benefits once the federal pandemic unemployment assistance program ends, and that's going to end right around Labor Day, September 6th. All right, quick break. When we come back, CWA Local 1102.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with cancer after taking Zantac? If you have taken Zantac and have cancer, you may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Ironworkers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 ironworkers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union ironworkers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our ironworkers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And, of course, you can follow us on Facebook and check us out on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number one, and welcome to the show, Mr. Steve Lawton. Steve has been president of CWA Local 1102 out of Staten Island, New York. He's had that position since 2015 and has served the local in several capacities going back to the year 2000. In fact, he started as a shop steward at Verizon, where he was employed since 1993. Boy, you think about all the changes in technology since that time. So Steve has seen a lot. We're also going to be joined later in the show with Hope Gilmore. Hope is a union activist and chief steward at Conduent Incorporated. I think I'm pronouncing it. Steve, am I pronouncing that correctly? Is that where Hope works?
Conduent
Incorporated.
Okay, yes, good, that is good, correct. Good.
Okay, we'll get to her in the second segment, but talk to me about yourself. Mentioned Verizon, 1993, and during that time, this is kind of interesting, I want to touch on this, I remember the strike that went on for 2 months. That was 5 years ago. So talk to me about working at Verizon. That being said, how are things going with Verizon today?
Well, you know, throughout my experience since 1993, we had actually several strikes. The one in 2015 was the longest one that I've ever been part of. But we've had, we had quite a few since 1993, smaller strikes. So in a way, some labor militancy was part of our history and our experience. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason why the union is so strong in the telecom, in the old telecom industries. I could tell you that since the strike of 2015, you know, I think we definitely accomplished a lot of goals during that strike. We feel like that was a winning strike. And a lot of the conditions after that strike have actually improved on an everyday basis.
Good.
Whether or not that's, you know, because of the strike or not, I can't scientifically say, but I can say that for whatever reasons, the company seems to have really come around to working with the union in a much more collaborative way than in the past.
Well, that's good to hear. Not like the workers in Topeka, Kansas at Frito-Lay. I don't know if you follow that. They just agreed on a new contract. They were working 84-hour work weeks there, and the temperatures in the kitchens where they're making the potato chips, 140 degrees. And I'm thinking, wait, is that a third world country? No, this is in the middle of America, Kansas. So I compare everything to that, and it's just sad that those workers had to go through that kind of thing. But on the positive side here, I see back 10 years ago, 2011, that you were the lead organizer in an organizing campaign for 300 call center workers. I'd like to touch on that. But let's talk about Local 1102. How many members? And maybe you can give us a little history on your local, okay?
Yeah, sure. So Local 1102 was chartered in 1965 as part of, the organizing that was taking place within the telecommunications industry at Ma Bell, as they said back in those days. And it actually, you know, people don't realize this. I don't know if people understand this structure, but, you know, not all the workers in the phone company at the time were in the union. And at that time, it was an open shop. So, you know, you'd have a union telecom worker next to a non-union worker, right? And 1102 was organized as one of the organizing campaigns back then when the vision of those labor leaders were to organize industry-wide. And, you know, we branched off, 1101 being our main local that was one of the original telecom locals in New York City. You know, it went from there and it branched out to the outer boroughs. And that's how 1102 came to be here on Staten Island.
And how many members do you have right now?
So currently, because we have workers at Verizon, we have workers at Conduent, we have approximately 500 members at this point. That has fluctuated, you know, through the years. But as you could imagine, with technological changes and changes in the economy, you know, just like most other unions in the private sector, we're feeling a big pinch in terms of our membership levels. But we're still holding, and that's where we currently stand.
Steve, I referenced the call center organizing, and I'm kind of familiar with that because, first of all, the CWA National is a sponsor. And we have updates from them on a monthly basis here on the show. And I know there's call center legislation. And as you know, a lot of those jobs went overseas. And people were frustrated with that. You did this organizing campaign for 300 workers. Can you kind of tell us how that went and how difficult that campaign was?
Well, you know, I would have to say the year was around 2009, and a group of workers who worked at a call center, which happened to be situated right across the street from one of our garages where our members worked. In fact, it was where I worked. And at that point, they had contacted us because they had seen us. You know, they had seen us either in some of our actions or just kind of like, you know, hanging out by where we worked. And they wanted a union, and they were like, you know, they were going to, at that point, you know, we're talking about the Easy Pass system in New York State. So it was in its infancy, you know, it was a new technology, and tolling was still done primarily by personnel in the toll booth, but it was shifting right into the call center environment, and the workers there were feeling that shift occur and the company becoming a little bit more you know, a little bit more corporate and things like that, and pushing on them. And they, so they reached out to us and they asked us, you know, hey, we'd like to, you know, we'd like to start a union here. And so we assisted them with that. And, you know, at that point, the company had changed hands. At that point, it was like Lockheed Martin actually was running that operation at the time. But it was sold off to a company in Texas called ACS. And ACS was vehemently anti-union, so much so that they actually hired a very expensive union avoidance specialist to come in and, you know, talk to the workers about why they shouldn't join the union. That campaign, the original campaign for recognition, included, you know, captive audience meetings that were strategic. You know, different groups of workers would be meeting with high level executives, depending on where they stood in their support of the union. The company routinely put out derogatory information around union leaders, and, you know, any information that they could find that, to point to try to undermine our credibility. They fired a whole department, you know, saying it wasn't related to the organizing, but ultimately had to bring all those workers back because they violated the Labor Act. You know, they did all those things that they do to avoid the union, which, you know, led us to the first contract. You know, we may have overcame those things, like, in some sense of it. But people have to understand that the union avoidance process isn't just about, like, avoiding the union from getting in. They also make it so that if the union does get in, that it's nearly impossible for it to make any sizable changes in the first couple of years to the workers' lives so that they could decertify us, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, they did a really masterful job of playing the orchestra, and it was very difficult to get them to the first contract. Of course, they delayed it to, you know, not hit the first contract, which really made it hard to keep everyone together. And of course, by the time we got to the first contract, we were in a position to try to get that contract solved as quickly as possible, right? Because it was like, you know, it's very hard to keep workers together fighting for something for two, three, going on third year.
And, sure.
You know, the union was, what the union avoidance person wanted was to get us to a point of decertification. So, you know, you either have to settle that contract or go through another vote on the union question. So we settled, and of course that's part of the plan, isn't it? Right?
Yeah.
They you know, the members aren't happy with that, right? They're like, hey, you know, this contract stinks. You know, we didn't get that transformation that we all want. And that set the tone for the next years, and that's when I really became really heavily involved. And of course, the decertification came up within the first year of the first contract, and we were having a very difficult time holding things together. In fact, the members, they actually ran a successful campaign to deauthorize our dues deduction first. So we lost the dues deduction first with this campaign because they weren't happy with the first contract. And then they set that up for the decertification, at which point I was an organizer before that. That's when they put me on as the lead organizer. And through an intensive home visit program where we went out every single night visiting with workers, we beat back the decertification back in 2010, 2011. And from there, that's when we really started our march. I'll leave it there and you can ask me questions. There's so much more to the story, but I think, you know, I want to see if you have any other questions.
Oh, well, I have more questions, but Steve, I am grateful that you told that story, because people do not realize what people like yourself go through in order to make things better for the workers around them. And that's a prime example. And what you did, I don't think could be taught in any college. I mean, that was a heck of a learning experience for you and all the members. And one that it's part of the playbook, I guess, in union organizing. But thank you so much for sharing that. There's another issue here, too, that I know you wanted to talk about, and it involves the government procurement process, which apparently has undermined your collective bargaining agreements. And can you get into some of that briefly?
Yeah, Yeah, and that's actually the second half of the story, which is since we overcame and beat back that union decertification, we went on to four consecutive contracts. Each one of them got a little bit better, so much so that we eventually even won agency shop back. So we went from decertification to building enough power because of that home visit campaign to really intense, right, that we actually got the union security back in the contract, right? And and that just happened in 2017, you know, in the last contracts. And so we were really moving towards a place of power and transformation that the members were really starting to grasp, and the ownership of the union was really growing amongst the members, which was something I'm very proud of. And just as we're doing that coming and surviving through this pandemic in 2020, during that time, this bid for this E-ZPass contract goes up again for bidding for the first time in 10 years since we reorganized. And the MTA awards the contract to a new contractor that doesn't even exist in New York State, right?
Oh,
so
no.
Effectively creating a situation where we are not promised any sort of retention and clearly not any recognition from the new company. And that's what we're currently dealing with at this very moment.
Wow, it's almost like they hit the reset button on that. What a story. Steve Lawton is joining us on our live line, and he is with CWA Local 1102 out of Staten Island, New York. That's CWA-1102.org. We're going to come back with him, and we're going to be joined by Hope Gilmore, who is a union activist and chief steward at Conduit Inc., and she's going to explain what that is all about. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you are exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, we're available on five platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. When you get an opportunity, just take a minute. Just a minute will do. And sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. And we always appreciate a good rating, like 5 stars. Let's go back to our live line and rejoin Steve Lawton on behalf of CWA. That's the Communication Workers of America, Local 1102, CWA-1102.org. Forgot to mention their Facebook page, and that's CWA Local 1102. Twitter handle is C WA1102. A lot of ways you can access them. That's how we are in America today. Steve, I know you want to bring a Hope Gilmore to the stage here. Why don't you give me a little background and how you got connected to Hope? Go ahead.
So, as I stated previously, in 2020, as most workers in this country were dealing with, we were dealing with the trauma of the pandemic in the early days. And one of the traumas that we had in the call center was the companies were not being forthcoming with information. And we were holding, you know, meetings and being there for the members, but we had limited information too. And at one night, we found out that there was a positive case and that COVID was spreading to the call center, which we anticipated was going to happen. Really wasn't getting a response from management about it. They did not have enough PPE. They weren't giving guidance to the members. So the members were like really dealing with that trauma on that one night. And what happened was I said to them, because it was the only thing I could do as their leader at the time, I'll be there in the morning. You know, I'm going to be there. And we're gonna deal with this situation. We're not gonna put our members in this harm's way. So 7 a.m. I don't recall this exact date, but 7 a.m. I show up and it's raining that morning. And you know, literally, we're just warning people as they go into the building that we have a positive case. We're advising them not to, you know, to make a thing of it and to, you know, maybe not go to work if that's what they chose to do. And, you know, just so that they knew. And one of the people that comes walking up to me, I find out later her name is Hope Gilmore. She comes up to me and she says, "Wow, you're here." And I says, "Yes, of course." And she literally took the flyer that we were handing out from my hands and started in the rain with her baby in tow, handing out the flyers and helping her coworkers, you know, notify them that this case had existed. And to the point where I had to ask her, like, "Hey, Hope, you know, I think you got to go to work, you know?" And she said, "Well, I'm not going to work. You know, I need to do this." And she brought her child to daycare and called out of work and, you know, helped us notify her coworkers. And that's how I met Hope Gilmore. It was in an action to protect our workers. And since that moment, Hope has been just a fabulous organizer, activist, someone who cares immensely about her coworkers and has really, she's basically in the role of lead organizer at this point, much like I was 10 years ago. And I feel so much confidence that even though we're going through this crisis, that we have such a talented organizer, rank and file organizer, who's going to lead us into the next battle. So, you know, I'd like to introduce Hope Gilmore.
What a great story. Hope, you are what every union needs. No doubt about that. Thanks for joining us here on America's Workforce. Well, Steve gave you the appropriate intro. Congratulations, and my hat's off to you and what you've done to help your local. Again, we're talking CWA Local 1102. I have to ask you, how old was your baby at the time when you were doing that?
He was 7 months.
7 months. But you didn't hesitate, right? You just took the bull by the horns, right?
Yes. I mean, I didn't expect him to show up. I did not expect Steve to show up. And when he did, it was surprising. And I was like, okay, great. I'm happy that he showed up. I needed information as well. I didn't feel safe going in the building knowing there was a possible case in the building and no information about that from the company. Mm-hmm. So I thought that would be important for everyone else to know too. You know, not even just EasyPass workers, but there are several other companies in that building. I felt they needed information as well. So every single person that walked up was like, "Hey, this is what's going on." Because I think that that's a safety issue. There are other people in that building that have families that they need to go home to, and they could possibly be bringing this virus that we had very little information on at that time to their families and to their babies.
Right, right. Now, you fought and won a work from home agreement from them. How long did it take to get that to happen?
That took a few months. We started that last year, maybe April, well, more like the end of March, April, and we won that by the end of April, beginning of May. Everyone was working from home, including myself. had not gone back in that building from that day that Steve and I had met, about March 17th or so, until May when I came to pick up my computer to go back home and work.
Yeah. Hope, what did they say to you? They said, oh, well, this virus is no big deal. Don't worry about it. What was their approach on all of this?
Oh, they gave no information whatsoever and tried to act as if it did not exist and as if there weren't positive cases. And when questioned, they tried to avoid answering it and tried to cover it up by saying, oh, well, we can't release that information because of HIPAA. And that's not true. You can't release the patient's information. Well, not patient, but the coworker's information. But you can say that there was a possible case and maybe a location would be great. That way everyone can do what they needed to do in order to feel safe if they felt like coming in.
Yeah. So what's the status right now? Are people still working from home? Are they back at the call centers? What's the case right now, Hope?
Everyone is still working from home for the most part. They do have people coming in occasionally due to technical issues with the computers, but we are still working from home. There's no information on when that will end.
Well, yeah, this Delta variant is pretty scary, and it's the pandemic of the unvaccinated right now, without a doubt. Okay, let's move on, because this was kind of a start for other good things in your union activism. I understand you worked on several political action campaigns, including the fight for the New York Heroes Act. Can you explain what that's all about, Hope?
Yes, that's my favorite. So that one, it's about safety. When you think about it, it's about safety in the workplace for everyone. No matter what your field is, everyone should be safe when they go to work. And if we have an event like this, where there's a pandemic, there should be PPE. There should be information. I had almost no information in my situation, and I pulled out due to that. And no one should have to feel that. No one should have that fear of, I don't know if it's okay for me to go to work today. So the New York Hero Act protects everyone, and there are plans that are being rolled out that have been rolled out. I think about July 5th from the Department of Labor and OSHA about how companies should deal with safety at the workplace, and there should be safety committees at every workplace. There should be enforcement of safety protocols, and the plans should be public to everyone.
Workers first and safety first. There's no doubt about it. So, Hope, what I want to do right now, if you would kindly turn the phone over to Steve, I want to wrap up with Steve here. I have another guest waiting in the wings, but thank you for what you're doing, and I'm sure Steve is pretty happy to have you on board, okay?
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
All right. That's Hope Gilmore, union activist, chief steward at Conduent, Inc. Hey, Steve, you got a good lady over there. You should be pretty proud about her.
I mean, it makes me very proud to be working with Hope and rank and file folks like Hope that are leading the way. It's the future of our movement, and I'm happy to. I always tell Hope I now work for her, so I'm happy to do it.
Roles are reversed a little bit, yeah. Hey, you know what? That's what unions are all about. We're all in this boat together, and we want to rise and make sure that everybody, union and non-union workers, are treated fairly. That's what it's all about. And hopefully those non-union workers will join the union. All right. We're going to wrap it up on that note. CWA1102.org. That's the website, CWA-1102.org. Steve Lawton is a president, and Hope Gilmore, union act. Boy, she is one to watch out for. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us. Really appreciate it.
Certainly good things happening at that local. We're talking about CWA Local 1102. Steve Lawton, president, and Hope Gilmore, union activist and chief steward at Conduent, Inc. You want to get some more information on the local? It's CWA-1102.org. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, John Schlois, head of the News Guild, is going to talk about an incredible year for organizing. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Chris LaGrange here, host of UCOM Live with Chris LaGrange. News, talk, sports, and workforce politics. The fastest growing podcast on, in, and around the internet. Join us live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter with archives on UCOMLive.com. Our loud and colorful panelists bring you current events like no other. So follow and subscribe today wherever great podcasts are found.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, celebrating 50 years. You can find more at ulagency.org. Before we get to John Schloss, you might want to check out, in case you missed Friday's show, we had Joyce Goldstein back. Joyce was off the show for about 4 months. She was working on a special project, which she's going to talk about at a future date. But she was talking about a memo released last week by the new general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, Jennifer Abruzzo, who comes from the Communication Workers of America. And it laid out a very clear agenda for all regional directors. And she said it this way: as our country fights a horrific pandemic and returns from an unprecedented economic recession, it is critical that the National Labor Relations Board vigorously protect the rights of workers to freely associate and act collectively to improve their wages and working conditions. Oh, my God, what a sea change. How about that? The General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board. And that show is archived at awfradio.com. Joyce Goldstein did a really good job on that. And there's like 11 issues that she's going to delve into. All right, let's go to line number two and rejoin this guy. This guy's been on the show a couple of times. He is on fire. He is an organizing guru, Mr. John Schloss, who's president of the News Guild, which is part of the CWA. Hey, John, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back, Flash.
So what's going on here? You're beating all previous records, 1,565 workers joining so far this year, another 1,000 in active public campaigns. John, what's going on?
Well, you know, it's all about the workers. I'm giggling with myself most days. Yeah. I mean, that's what the number is right now. By the end of this week, it's going to be more. We've got, like you said, you know, we've got 14 active public campaigns in addition to the 31 campaigns that have already been won by workers so far this year. It's places like Insider, which, you know, used to be Business Insider. It's places like the Southern California News Group, a group owned completely by the hedge fund Alden Global Capital. It's the Atlantic Magazine editorial department. It's Forbes. It's nonprofits like Raisi's, and groups like the ACLU in different areas. Everyone wants to organize, and as a union leader, we've got to stand up and make sure that there's the capacity to make that happen.
Well, you mentioned the hedge funds, and the hedge funds have really delved into journalism. They're buying up big news outfits and a slash cost. Is that what's, I mean, obviously, wages, healthcare, is that what, they're just making conditions miserable for the workers at those various institutions? Is that what's happening?
That's definitely a huge part of it. I think that for so long, a lot of journalists who were not in a union workplace have realized that, you know, turns out that democracy and having a voice in the workplace is a better option than letting your publication slowly slide away into the hands of a hedge fund that will just cut pay, close the office and the newsroom. If it's like, you know, a center point of the community, they'll cut things like 401k match for people's retirement. I mean, it's really bad stuff. And all the global capital recently bought 2 months ago, Tribune Publishing, which is a huge publisher of places like the Chicago Tribune, the Hartford Courant, the Allentown, Pennsylvania Morning Call, the Orlando Sentinel, many, many others. We've pretty much, there's a union in every single one of those shops, and they're heading back to the bargaining table soon. But it's rough going. I mean, and you know, when you have a union, you have the ability to enforce status quo if you're brand new, and you could also fight to, you know, make sure that you've got better conditions when the company, at the end of the day, ends up being profitable.
And your organizing is across the board here in a lot of right-to-work states, I might add. I notice in Texas you organize the Dallas Morning News and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. I can only assume with the labor environment in a state like Texas, that had to be kind of difficult. Can you reflect on that?
You know, I originally just grew up in a neighboring state. I grew up in Arkansas, and it wasn't like I grew up with a culture of understanding what unions were in the South. That was not a priority of Southern culture. But I think that when you sit down and you work through the issues that workers have, and then you talk about the tools that every worker has, there's this misconception, and that we've done a bad job of marketing what the power of a union is to people, because there's a misconception, you know, that, oh, well, if you're not allowed, you're legally not allowed to join a union in some of these right to work states. That's what people think. They don't realize it's really just a question of, you know, dues being paid or not. In Texas, you know, at the Dallas Morning News, which organized earlier this year, this amazing group of hundreds and hundreds, or well, dozens and dozens of journalists, they, that's a publication that actually invented the phrase in an editorial opinion section piece, right to work. And they unionized at 75% or 70% yes vote. I think that any worker, no matter where they are, can actually form a union. It's really just a matter of explaining the process and where their power is, and then giving them more of it by getting them to use it.
You know, one of the strategies with the owners of these publications are saying, well, you know, newspapers have kind of, you know, toned down. They don't have the content they once did, but it's all going digital. And they're not making enough money to pay their people, their reporters, their journalists. I'm just wondering if that environment is changing, because, as you know, I mean, everything is going online. Is that starting to pick up revenue? What are you hearing?
Well, yeah, you're seeing, you know, one of the problems with an industry that has been stabilized by a century of the same business model, right? I.e., we print this thing, we distribute it across town, by the way, usually with independent contractors who are excluded as employees. And then you sell mostly advertisements in that newspaper. That's where most of the revenue used to come from. Now it's completely flipped, which is really good to see. And we can see it in places like the New York Times, which is a very stable, large company. They actually, you know, recently in the last year have seen more and more revenue come from subscribers. So this is what we call circulation revenue. So it's less and less revenue, even if it's digital, from advertising, more and more from circulation, which is really good, I think, for us as consumers, because it means these publications now have to be more responsive and more accountable to the subscribers, to the actual individual, not the corporations like Walmart or Target or Macy's, but the actual people who are purchasing.
You mentioned the New York Times. You got to share the story that's going on there. Now the journalists, the writers at the New York Times are in a union. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, we've had a union at the New York Times since the 1940s, one of the original American Newspaper Guild units. Includes all the writers, includes a huge chunk of other services, I mean, including the security guards at the front door. Yeah. This week or last week, we actually, we've been in this process to unionize as more and more companies shift to digital. We've been in the process of working with the workers, about 600 folks that are data analysts, engineers, product, you know, we call them managers, but they're not supervisors in the traditional sense. All these different groups to build the backbone infrastructure. So if you've ever used the New York Times app, if you've ever used the Crosswords app, if you've ever used the Recipes app, if you've been to the website on election night, these are the people who basically power the software behind the curtain at the New York Times. 600 and plus folks trying to build a union with us. And the company keeps fighting. Last week, they decided enough was enough, and more than 300 of them went out on a half-day strike, a half-day work stoppage on Wednesday.
And the interesting part of this story, apparently the Times hired a union-busting law firm. Let's be honest here. Union-busting law firm, and they don't want these workers to be organized, apparently. And talk to me about the memo that went to the wrong person.
Yeah, so there's a lot of these groups out there, the union busting law firms, and you know they kind of range in different buckets of probably different circles of hell is where they'll end up. I wonder though. These are people. These are human beings that you know
right.
Have to get up every day. I do wonder how they go to sleep at night. But Proskauer is a firm that's particularly at the New York Times. The folks over at the Teamsters Local 804 had a pretty clever tweet. Proskauer, more like amateur scour. They accidentally emailed around their union busting strategy, which was a little PowerPoint slide deck that included a slide that said, here's our general understanding of the sentiment of the union in the different places inside this organizing effort. And here's the ways that we could bust the union most effectively, and here's the different strategies by, you know, basically limiting, trying to divide people, trying to, you know, say that these people are supervisors when they're clearly not. It's basically an internal roadmap that was leaked out, and the Daily Beast wrote about it last week as well. It's pretty ridiculous stuff.
So, John, what happened after that, after it was disclosed that they sent it to the lead organizer in the New York Guild?
Well, it basically ticked everyone off, rightly so, because the company itself has held this very specific line, right? Companies like to third-party the union. They like to talk about this union, this big, bad union, you know, over in Washington, D.C., that's going to make you do all these things. When in reality, anyone who goes through the process realizes that the union is the workers, right? It's all of us together. And the company basically has been saying, you know, the union's going to make you do all these things. And at the same time, we want to make sure that everyone has the ability to vote and that there's a fair vote for everyone. They're gaslighting us. And it's clear that they're gaslighting the workers through this slide deck, because what they want to do is they want to divide people out. They want to try to separate out subgroups and force folks into hearings at the National Labor Relations Board. That's just a strategy to slow things down and try to beat them. They did the same thing at the Writers Guild East with Hearst Magazines. It's another union that represents journalists. And it took months for those hearings to go through. And eventually the union-busting law firm and the company lost, and there was one unit.
Boy, if anything, John, I think it makes the unit even stronger. All good news coming out of the News Guild. John Schlois joining us on our live line. You want to get some more information, newsguild.org. John, let's check in a couple of months, and maybe there'll be a couple thousand more members in the News Guild. What do you think?
We definitely have the potential for that. And, you know, we've got millions of workers across this country. Everyone's got to do their part to organize them all.
Amen to that. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the latest from the Ohio Federation of Teachers and the Painters and Allied Trades. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.